do we sometimes impose our goals of care on the patient as opposed to getting their input on the goals of care? Because it's their care plan. It's not our care plan.
Welcome to Transcending Home Care. Stan Massey of Transcend Strategy Group holds vital discussions with other experts on insights and ideas to help providers succeed in the ever-changing landscape of home-based healthcare. For more than 18 years now, Stan has helped providers of home-based care build their brands to increase referrals, admissions, patient days, and performance scores. This episode features a conversation with special guest Cooper Linton, Associate Vice President of Duke Home Care and Hospice at Duke University Health System. Anyone who knows Cooper knows he's a passionate advocate for patient-centered care. Listen as he shares insights, opinions, and advice from more than 20 years of experience with home-based care organizations.
Welcome, Cooper, and thanks so much for joining us on our podcast. We're here today to discuss your thoughts on improving the patient experience. There's no single magic bullet, but what do you feel is a major key to unlocking the best patient experience possible? Where do we start to improve?
Thank you, Stan. I'm happy to be on the podcast with you. I think the first thing we have to do is get out of the idea that we know what the consumer actually wants, what the patient and family really wants. We tend to want to walk into the conversation or walk into the idea of what is patient experience with the idea that we already know what they want. And that's a pretty dangerous thing. Talk to some people. Ask what matters to them. What would you like to experience? And what they may value out of a healthcare experience, particularly when they are having that experience in their own home, is very likely different than what we think it is. I think we need to start with the assumption that we don't know it all.
That's a really good point. We know that communication and the very language that we use is really important. Can you share some examples that come to mind of how a shift in language can spark a shift in perspective, maybe away from the clinical and more toward a relationship?
I'll be happy to start with one that comes to mind first, just because it's the first thing that we often do in home health or hospital. We accept an invitation into care in someone's home and to join them in a care journey. That's really different than we admitted a patient today. Because admitting a patient is something we do to a patient. Accepting an invitation into a journey of care with a patient is something we do with them. If we can begin to shift our language, shift our thinking about that, then I think we're actually going to begin the journey of changing the way patients experience our care and their families experience our care.
So how do you think emotional intelligence comes into play here? You talked about language, but also just the skills of reading a person's mood or the tone of what they say or even their body language. How important a role does emotional intelligence play in communicating and building a relationship with patients and families?
I think the immediate response is, of course, to say it's incredibly important. And it obviously is. When we begin to look at care in any setting, emotional intelligence is critical. When we begin to look at care in the patient's home setting, there is now a requirement of having a PhD in emotional intelligence, because we're no longer assessing how they are responding to our setting of care. We have to become integrated into their setting of care. So we are now part of their social construct. We're now part of their cultural expectations. And those are often things we don't have to deal with as acutely when we own the setting of care. If you're in our clinic, if you're in our hospital, in any setting where the patient comes to the provider, there's a very different balance of power just based on the location of care. When we walk into someone's living room or their bedroom, we're in someone's kitchen, we're doing an assessment on someone's bathroom for safety, there's an intimacy in that that absolutely demands sensitivity, cultural awareness, cultural fluency, and essentially being aware of the environment and the way the family is perceiving you and the way the patient's perceiving you. And we need to be very careful that we don't begin to look, do things that could be perceived as harmful from a perspective of being emotionally disrespectful. People are really vulnerable to that in their own home. I think it's also important that we not be judgmental of the setting of care. We walk into homes that may not have the same resources that we'd have in our own, and that frankly, we may not find all that pleasant, but the patient and family should never experience our perception of their environment in that way.
Really interesting insights, Cooper. You were talking about things that are very personal and real world in dealing with patients and families and their home environment. I've had the opportunity to hear you speak in the past about how sometimes, especially something like an intake process, can really feel more like a transaction than an act of care. So could you comment a little bit on that and some of the changes we might start looking at creating so that it is more about the relationship than a transaction?
I would love to, because I think we have created a process, and a lot of this, I'm not trying to fault us as providers. I am trying to describe what we do as providers. And so in some ways, I think I have to accept some blame for this myself. We deal with a set of Medicare regulations for how to admit a home health patient, set of Medicare regulations for how to admit a hospice patient. There's a set of questions that we need to ask. There are specific forms that we need to get with respect to consent and to get patients to elect to go on to home health or to elect to go on to hospice. And that's all important, but those are transactions in the process of care. And if the transactions are what's steering the engagement, then we have a transactional engagement. We need to begin to shift to a relational engagement with the patient, and that those specific transactions are simply incidental to the relationship, the therapeutic relationship that we create with patients and their family members, their loved ones, be they family or not, that are in that home. So when we do a visit with a social worker, how do we do that to make sure that we're covering all the things we should cover from a documentation perspective, from a Medicare or Medicaid regulation perspective? But how do we wrap that in a way that helps a patient understand their own dignity, where they feel respected in the process, that they are actually included in the discussion of what the plan of care is? I think often when we talk about a patient being non-compliant, it's because the patient is also in disagreement. It's not simply non-compliance. Sometimes it's disagreement with the plan of care because there's disagreement about the goals of care. And I must sometimes ask, do we sometimes impose our goals of care on the patient as opposed to getting their input on the goals of care? Because it's their care plan. It's not our care plan. And we talk about this is our care plan for the patient. No, we are a participant in the patient's care plan. We're not receiving care. It can't be our care plan. We may have had the privilege of drafting it and writing this in concert with the patient and their doctor, but it is the patient's care plan. And we need to make sure that they have a sense of ownership in it, both from a participation, but also from a respect perspective.
A lot of what we've been talking about really addresses the mindset of an organization's culture. So what are some of the ways you've seen or experienced to instill a truly patient-centered mindset into an organization's DNA?
I think part of this circles back to something we touched on earlier. Do we actually know what the patient and family thinks? Have we asked them? So part of it is getting the patient's perspective. I think a great way to do that in a more systematized manner is to use patient and family advisory councils. They are sometimes called different things in different places. But ask patients and families to look at the way you do things and get their feedback. Ask them what their experience was. Do an in-person survey after a visit. You know, we recently had a project at Duke Home Care and Hospice where we sent two people into patient homes and interviewed the patient after visits, after admissions. And it was really part of an emotional journey mapping process that was done in concert with the Patient Family Advisory Council. And it was incredibly insightful because our patients and families can teach us so much about how we can deliver care differently. What does it feel like to be admitted into home health or hospice? And if we can ask that question and internalize those responses, that alone begins to change culture. Also changing language. We touched on that briefly earlier, but if we begin to change our language, we begin to change the way we think. For the most part, most of us think in words. And so if we begin to change the words that we think with, it can really inform how we shape our ideas around the delivery of care.
That emotional journey map idea is really outstanding and appreciate you sharing that with us. We talk about patient experience, and we know that a lot of that is dependent on how providers actually deliver the care. It's the touch points with the patient and family in that care journey. But when you step back and think about it for even half a second, a lot of what we've talked about may require at least a little extra time from our staffing and at every touch point along the way. So I think, you know, philosophically, what we've been talking about makes so much sense. But as far as practicality of delivery, how do you think this approach will affect things like caseloads and staffing models, or maybe even different ways we can provide care so that we have the best of both worlds, that we have the time to deliver care and the emotional intelligence to do it from a perspective that's meaningful to the patient?
I think the timing of your question as it relates to kind of the impact we're beginning to feel from value-based purchasing is actually beautiful, because as we begin to shift from a model that has been based on visits, how many visits did we make? How many visits should you make? What are the visit expectations? How do we measure productivity in hours and in visits? And it's been very numerically driven. And I understand the need to measure things, and I'm fully supportive of it. But we need to make sure we're measuring the right things. And so as we move toward value-based purchasing, which is really just another way of saying, are we delivering the best care possible in the most efficient way possible? It's an opportunity for us to step back and say, are we really delivering the encounters in the home? And I use the term encounters, not visits. Are we using the encounters in the home in the best way possible? Have we had such a focus on visit productivity that we may have missed whether or not we've really given people more than they can care manage? We talk about case management. I prefer the term care management. We should be in a relationship of care with a patient. This is a person, and we should be in the care management business. And have we created staffing models that bake into the model not only the number of patients, but the acuity of patients, the geographic location of them, and what we really want done during those visits? Do we need more visits, or do we need better visits? And if staff have time to make relational, deeper visits, would they actually need as many to begin with? And I'm not in any way trying to shortchange patients on how many visits they get. It could sound like, hey, we're just trying to cut back on the number of visits. We're actually trying to increase the amount of time that's spent in meaningful engagement between the professional caregiver and the patient and their loved ones. And I'm not convinced that a productivity model that's based strictly on counting visits gets us there, because we're back to transactions. We need to create staffing models that have enough bandwidth for the provider to really begin to elevate their professional practice and create deeper therapeutic relationships with patients. That's a little scary for some of us on the business side. It's a little scary for folks that are on the metrics management side of the business. But as we move toward value-based care and trying to greatly reduce the number of patients who are receiving emergency room services or having unnecessary readmissions, we're going to have more time with that family. We can't have a 15 to 20 minute goals of care discussion. We're going to have longer conversations. And that relationship allows us to really talk about how realistic some of those goals that a patient has may be. How realistic is it that you're going to get better? Or how realistic is it that you're going to be able to drive a car? Again, we can't have a transactional visit that addresses that. It takes time, and it takes some rapport building. And clinicians need the time to do that, or they're really going to begin to question, is this something that they want to do from a career perspective?
Very good point. Do you feel that these interactions with patients have to be in person to be effective, or is there going to be a growing role for telemedicine? Any even tools like FaceTime and Skype, is there a role for that to have some good interpersonal relationships without necessarily having to be there face-to-face?
You know, we won't know really what does and what doesn't work until the data comes back. We're not going to get the data back until we try some things. So let me zoom out for just a second. Every time we get a large number of healthcare folks together, we start talking about 10,000 baby boomers hitting the Medicare rolls every single day. We talk about the reduced number of caregivers that are going to be available at the end of the next decade and the following decade to care for an aging population. And frankly, Stan, the math is ugly. The math is not supportive of being able to deliver care the way we've always done it. So as we continue to look at how do we build relationships and we have encounters, we're going to have to look at, can some of those encounters be through technology? And the technology is actually there in most situations. We're doing a lot of telemedicine from hospital to hospital, clinics to hospitals. What we've not done a whole lot of in the industry of post-acute or non-acute care is beginning to use the patient's own devices or the patient's family's devices to increase patient encounters. And I use the term encounters, not visits, because you're not necessarily going out to the home in real time and space. But you can talk with a family member about their fears of a loved one dying over the phone. And if it's done face-to-face through teleconference, it's even better. You can show us symptoms over a phone. And so I think many of us are beginning to say, look, if we don't have enough people and we don't have enough money to throw at the problem or the challenge of dealing with a very large and rapidly increasing aging population, we're going to have to apply technology. Stan, which of those technologies is going to work? I don't know. But I know that anything that we can do that we can engage with our patients and their loved ones in a way that's HIPAA compliant, I'm not suggesting we start running things through non-HIPAA platforms, but there's ways to do this in a HIPAA compliant world. Any way that we can do that will enhance care, enhance the number of touches, even if they're virtual touches, that a patient and family experience. And if we can't go there in person, maybe we can go there virtually, or maybe we can augment an in-person visit with a virtual visit by a nurse practitioner or a virtual visit by a doctor, or begin an intervention on call earlier virtually that we then continue when we're able to get a nurse into the home. We're going to have to look at using technology in a different way. We're beginning to see training videos used to teach therapy patients in lieu of making additional visits. Saw a presentation recently on that, and it sounded hokey until you saw the outcome numbers. So there's some interesting stuff out there that we're going to have an open mind about, because we can't solve the future problem using today's logic.
That makes a lot of sense, my friend. Do you have any other final thoughts on improving the patient experience that we haven't covered?
The first thing we have to do, if I could leave on one point, for all that we have worked in this industry, there's so many exceptional professionals out there. And we want to be professional, we want to be experts in our field. But if we could all show up to work with an humble heart about what we know or what we don't know, and be open to learning from the people that we serve, our patients and their loved ones, if we could bring that humbleness to it, I think we'll greatly gain insight into what they really want from us, and in the end, be better prepared, better enabled to meet their needs.
Amen to that. And I want to humbly thank you for sharing such provocative and just really, I think, deep insights and things to think about with your comments today. Really appreciate you joining me, Cooper.
Thank you for having me on, Stan.
Thanks for listening. Watch for future episodes of Transcending Home Care on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. For more content, visit transcendgroup.consulting. You can also hear more from Cooper Linton on a podcast he co-founded called Edge of Aging. Episodes are available at edgeofaging.com.